You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm bringing you the second part of my conversation with stand-up comic and comedy actor David Cross. You might want to download the first part to get some context on this one, but if you haven't done that, you can probably charge straight in. Keep listening for details of the exclusive extra content from David's CD, It's Not Funny, that he mentioned last week, that is now exclusively available via this podcast. It's sort of, you can think of it like a hidden track. If you remember, we also talked about David's early material, his anger and how it manifests in his comedy and his life. And now we're straight back into discussing offence and outrage. Here's David Cross. In It's Not Funny, when you're talking about Bush executing, in your words, retarded people, mm-hmm. I think that seems to me, from my listening of American phrase, that's a less PC phrase.
Yes, that's an old... I had an old bit about Bush electrocuting retarded people.
Okay.
That's from my stand-up. That's not in that thing. That's like old. Like one of the first things when I... You wouldn't have heard it. It's one of the first things where I started to shift into more of that stuff. In response to your question from earlier, the first Bush, mm-hmm. I think that was a reference to that, and that was a real thing where he did execute people he knew that were retarded in the state of Texas. But anyway, go ahead.
So, because I've heard that bit. I thought that was on one of your CDs.
It is, but it's a reference to an older bit. Yeah, because his father also did that as well.
I understand. So, but with things like that, and the line is, you know, every time Bush executes a retarded person, an angel gets his wings.
I forgot about that. That's funny.
So
I'm going to have to check me out.
So with something like that, where that could cause outrage, one would imagine, in some audiences. Let me ask the question I was going to ask. How do you develop stuff like that when, like, there must be a point at which you get traction with some crowds and not with others?
Yeah, you just stand by it. If you believe in it, going back to you've referenced a couple times, you know, my fearlessness, which I don't see as fearlessness. It's just what I am and who I am. And I would argue that other people, where I don't have a filter, I think other people do, and that's cowardly. But that doesn't necessarily mean I'm fearless. You know what I mean? In a relative sense, everything being equal, I think they're cowardly more than I'm fearless. If that makes sense. It's just, you know, that's a thing. I just don't have that thing in me that wants to please everybody, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, and I want to have a good set, and I want people to like me, absolutely. And I want to have a great set. But I'm not going to not do a bit because I think it's going to upset some unseen person in the back who I don't know who the fuck they are, you know? And
Are you ever in environments when you have to decide to do a bit even though you know it's going to upset everybody?
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. But that's... I get gleeful about that, you know? And again, it's less so now. A lot of this applies more to the first 10 years I was doing stand-up. And there's a certain amount of, all right, get ready for this. This should be fun, you know, because I definitely want to do that bit because I like it. I know it's done well. I know other people like it, people I respect and trust. And I've done it before on numerous occasions, and it works really well. You just have to stand by your bit. You have to have conviction of the idea and the bit. And I do, you know, unless I'm just riffing something. And if I don't, then sometimes I'll apologize and maybe even say, like, oh, that was a bit much. That's not funny. But, I mean, okay. I have jokes that involve rape.
Yeah.
Not the physical act. I mean, the physical act. But they reference rape. And the joke wouldn't exist if the word rape wasn't in it. But I stand by the jokes, you know. And I've certainly, whatever it was, 3 months ago, 4 months ago, whatever it was. It was a while ago. It was the last set I did. It was a good 4 or 5 months ago. But I was in Brooklyn. And I did this joke that I really like. I did it the other night. You were at Happy Mondays.
Yes, I was, yeah.
Obviously, that's how this... All right. The thing about the guy on trial for date rape.
Yes.
So I started that joke, and then there was a woman, of course. It's probably going to happen once every 3-4 times. You know, who said, you know, why don't you go home or something like that? Or I can't remember what it was. It was like, stop. That's not funny. It's a rape. Like, there are plenty of people who think you can't possibly make a funny joke once the word rape or the concept of rape is involved. And I think that's absurd. Again, demonstrably, at least, I mean, comedy's subjective, but demonstrably untrue.
Let just to pursue that then. There's a difference between not caring about pleasing people and not caring about offending people, and somewhere along that line is sort of
a huge difference.
Yes, yeah.
Yes. And again, I don't. I want to please people. I just won't alter my stuff to please people. I mean, I will comment on it, and I will try to win an audience back, and But I'll just do it in varying degrees. I'm not going to abandon my material. I may present it a different way. I may keep trying. One thing I've always done ever since I started was comment on the situation. It's never bothered me to go, wow, this isn't working. Mm. You know, let's see how we can make this work. I'm not a bad guy. You know, I understand you didn't like that bit. And just talk to them as human beings, and hopefully they see you as a human being. But yeah, there's a huge difference between not caring about pleasing people and not caring about offending them. I completely don't give a shit about offending people. Never have, ever.
Is there an element by which you enjoy offending people?
Yes.
And what's that about? If you're not going out of your way, but making it your way to offend people?
Well, are they offended by the words? Are they offended by the concept? Are they offended by me? Are they offended by me saying those words? Are they offended? I mean, there's so many ways to offend somebody. And most of the ways that people get offended, most of the ways they react when they're offended are, it's a heightened drama. It's a form of narcissism. And it's anti-intellectual sometimes.
The act of taking offense, you mean?
What I'm talking about. Like, you know, the idea that, you know, I say something about Orthodox Jews and people get offended, but they're offended for weird reasons. And when I get offended at different things. And the stuff, mostly like a comedian making a joke about, you know, I guess I get offended in a purist's way, you know, where like that anti-Arab joke makes no sense, you know,
yeah,
it's
okay.
not about
yeah.
it being anti-Arab, but I get offended at just like easy shock stuff, and I just, it doesn't, you know, I guess ultimately also, you know, like, well, I didn't hurt anybody with that. Let's move on. That was, that was a thought. That was a thought I put out there. It took about 20, 30 seconds, maybe.
Okay.
Let's move on. But if, for what I talk about, my subject matter, whether it's, you know, politics or religion, I don't give a shit about offending somebody who, you know, because they're Jewish or Christian or Muslim or atheist or whatever. I don't care.
But in the context of the two examples that we've talked about, you've, on the one hand, there's the Bush capital punishment kind of issue.
Look at these notes.
Yeah, I know, man. Wow. in the context of those two examples, there's on the one hand, there's the Bush capital punishment thing, which one might say is deserving of a joke because that's it's an important point.
Well, you would say...
But okay, sure.
But there are plenty of people who wouldn't say.
Okay, yeah, no,
they'd be offended by
okay.
That.
So, you know, bearing that in mind,
yeah, that's
and then on, and then on the other hand, there's the joke about date rapists, which I, because we're talking about it, can you just tell us what that in brief what that joke is?
No,
which is
the it won't translate if I tell it.
Okay,
you know.
Okay, I just would like people to be able to understand.
There's performance involved, and I don't want to do it.
But okay, but it's fair to say that that joke is, or is it fair to say that that joke is, that's kind of like a riff on an idea about the a date rapist defending himself in court, and that maybe is that, does that have less kind of societal value to the one about Bush executing people with learning difficulties?
I don't care. I'm up there. I mean, unless we're talking about a you know, doing 30 minutes in New Cross, if we're talking about the work that I'm putting out there for everybody, you know, like the CDs, the specials and stuff like that. I mean, I don't care regardless, but I don't care about social value. There, some jokes have zero, they have less than zero social value. I'm not up there for an hour and a half. Everything has to be about social value. That'd be boring to me. I'm not that good at that. I'm not Bill Hicks, you know. I have things that I'm passionate about, and clearly as my body of work increases, you can point to some stuff and go, well, look at that. You've got 3 hours on religion, you know. Mm-hmm. So clearly that's, but you know, in a show, if I'm doing an hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever, I mean, that's, religion is what, 25-30% of my, maybe, you know, even peripherally, part of my set. I mean, there's a lot of stuff, and I've never, nor do I want to try to make every second have social value.
No, but what I mean is, in terms of whether or not someone gets offended, I might look at it and go, well, it's okay for people to be offended by the idea that the state is killing people with learning difficulties, because that's a thing that's worth talking about. But doing a sort of I don't know, is it a glib joke about a date rapist? But then if someone gets offended at that, I sort of, do you see what I mean in terms of the...
Yeah, but I hear what you're saying, but I don't, I guess it comes back around to, I don't care. I don't care to engage in a, although I'm doing exactly that, a debate about, you know, what has more leeway in its offensive, you know, quantitative offensive qualities, and what's okay and what's not okay. I just don't care. It's specifically the date rapist on trial joke is just a joke. Here's a joke we can talk about, because let's forget the date rape thing. Here's something that I did in the last special. It's easy. We'll talk about this. I love my wife very much. I'm really not selling this joke very well. I love my wife very much. I love her so much. I got her two vibrators. I mean, I'm paraphrasing my own joke. It was in the last special, but you know, I got her two vibrators. You know, one for home and one for her to take with her. You know, in case she's raped. And that's, it's one of those ooh jokes, but it's it's certainly one that some people didn't think was funny, and that's fine. You know, you should never, ever, ever debate intellectually like we're doing whether a joke or comedy is funny. I have my idea, and I can articulate why I don't think it's funny, but I can't make it funny to you. That sure. It is what it is. Part of it is the context. If I wrote that down and put it as a submission in The New Yorker, not funny. If a guy is saying it in the context of the middle of a joke as a throwaway thing, kind of a little bit funnier. But let's talk about that, because that's one that people are like, ooh. Mm. But I don't care. It's just a dumb... Nobody really got raped. I'm not condoning it. I'm not advocating it.
Do you think... I mean, this isn't... I don't know how much time we should spend on this, but do you think that there is...
podcast.
Do you think that there is a validity in people's anger at rape jokes? Because one of the arguments I hear against
people... It depends
on
the joke. If it's a well-crafted joke, then no. And if it's a just shock value thing where it's almost kind of violent, misogynistic, then sure, yeah. And that's just me. That's my opinion. There's no arbiter. It is what it is. And, you know, there's no ultimate judge who's saying, hey, I can't send this to Oxford and have it, you know, sent around and studied, and then they come back with a specific, well, actually, it's a 61%, yeah. You know, I mean, it's subjective.
So is there anything that you would find offensive that you wouldn't?
There's plenty I find offensive. Subject matter?
Yeah, subject matter in terms of...
I think when there are real people who are innocent victims, I those jokes are tough. They may be funny, but they're...
Specific people, you mean, rather than...
Yeah.
Rape
like
as
specific,
a concept that is
yes,
a thing that
yes.
happens. I understand.
That bothers me when they're... You know, when people make jokes like... like when an athlete gets away, like the Ray Rice thing, and I guess she came back to him, so it's less, but I don't even know if anybody will get that reference, American sports guy, but you know, when somebody somebody's accused of rape, usually like somebody connected and wealthy, a celebrity, an athlete, a politician, or somebody, and this might be more specific to America, where we're in an ugly period right now, a lot because of the right wing and Fox News, and they blame the victim first. It's always about you put it through the filter of, well, did she deserve it? What didn't, you know? And there's a person, and this news has just come out, say, in the last 72 hours, and people make jokes, a lot of shock jocks on the radio make jokes about this person who is innocent, never asked for this. So, you know, this infamy, never asked for any of it, and potentially could have been raped by a guy who's going to get away with it. And people make jokes about, you know, fill in the blank, whoever that girl or woman was. I find those jokes offensive. Things like that, or things where there's an innocent victim who did nothing to merit this awful, harsh, national kind of making fun of them, when it's a real person, that bothers me.
Have you ever done that in the past? Not necessarily about rape victims, say, but have you zeroed in on a specific individual and then ever had a situation
no.
where you've had to kind of change your thinking on it or retract, like you've met the person or you've hurt someone that's actually been tangible?
Well,
because the reason I ask
not
is
in
oh,
that
the
way.
Part of the reason why I feel maybe less free than I could be on stage to say whatever I want is part of it is a fear of hurting someone. Part of it is wanting to please people and trying
right.
to keep a check on that as a you know as a level. And part of it is not wanting to injure someone to
right.
hurt another person. And is that something that you don't that doesn't come up?
No, there are numerous jokes. I make jokes about my family, have for years, but there are numerous jokes I've thought of that I don't do because it would hurt their feelings as individuals, you know, my mom or one of my two sisters. I just don't do them, you know, and I've thought about it. Maybe it's something I'll tell my wife or somebody who knows everybody, and it's a funny joke, but this is going to hurt their feelings, and I don't do that. And that's about it. I don't think I don't make fun of somebody who doesn't kind of quote unquote deserve it, you know, like Kim Kardashian, Paris Hilton, people who I find reprehensible and are rewarded for their disgusting, amoral, antisocial, terrible behavior. I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem making fun of Kanye West. And a lot of people invite that kind of thing. That's fine. And I think anybody who puts themselves out there in a very calculated way puts themselves out there because they want to be famous, so they feel they deserve it. They're entitled. And then, yeah, you can make fun of them. But I really don't make fun of that many people outside of that, except for maybe... I'm trying to think of specific people. The Pope. He's a big boy. You can take it.
So thank you for all your feedback on the first episode of this conversation. David is going to talk in a moment about his years spent as a road act. That's a comic that buzzes up and down the country on planes and buses and cars. And what that experience gave him. Now, I particularly mention that because I achieved a career first. I don't know if achieved is the right word. Something happened. I did something that I've never done in 20 years of being a performer. I conflate my 10 years as a street performer with my 10 years as a comic in that, for reasons that will become clear. I turned down a gig because I considered it unplayable. I've never done that before. I'm absolutely used to turning up and just hacking my way through any old shit set of circumstances. I'm going to tweet a picture of it, actually, so you can see the specific circumstances of this gig. But I turned up as part of the Leamington Spa Comedy Festival, the otherwise brilliant, I should say, Leamington Spa Comedy Festival, which is very close to my heart because I grew up in Leamington Spa, which is a little town in the West Midlands. And, I mean, it was lovely. I really enjoyed it. I did the big final show there. I did a Comedy for Kids show there. I emceed a new act night with some great new acts, including Jack Heal, who I'd never seen before. He was absolutely superb, so look out for him. Anyway, that's not the story. The point is that I did this big finale show and I was able to do incredibly local material of the way that I often can't do because I'm... because I'm from somewhere really tedious. Leamington Spa, I think the problem with Leamington, much as I love it, the problem with it from the perspective of a comic is that it doesn't have a cultural identity. People in Leamington don't know what they are. There seems to me, in terms of the audiences there, to be very little sense of cultural sort of cohesion because they're not... You know, the extreme examples would be people like Glaswegians or Scousers or even Bristolians are aware that there is a cultural stereotype about Bristolians. But there's no stereotype about Leamingtonians, if that's even what they're called. I suppose people think they're a bit posh. They're not specific. We aren't really that posh. So there's not a lot for a kind of an incoming comic to work with besides sort of, hey, you're a bit posh, all the rest of it. I was able to do some ferociously local material about how they've just had a Wagamama's built there, and I remember the days when you could turn left off the parade, which absolutely killed. So that was you know, not the sort of material I could do in literally any other town. But that had all gone very well. The Leamington Spa Comedy Festival was fantastic. And then what happened was I went to do a little sort of additional bolt-on gig at the Leamington Spa Irish Club. The comics amongst you will instantly spot all the danger signs. Let's see if non-comedians can tell when I first started to worry. So I got the email and I'm going to go on and do 20 minutes in between a band. That's got to be the first red flag. So there's a band on, then they're going to stop. And presumably already my mind's racing and I'm thinking, OK, what's going to happen here is someone's going to shuffle on stage and say... So sorry to stop all the music you've been enjoying. Here's a comedian you've never heard of. So I thought, okay, I've played worse situations. I've played weddings where they're all looking at you going, why are you doing jokes about yourself and not about the bride and groom? I've been in all sorts of horrific, borderline unplayable situations. I turned up at the gig I was met by a very chipper-looking guy in his early 40s, I would say, who seemed excited to see the young man from London town, as far as he knew, in a blazer, turning up, ready to be thrown to the wolves. I then went round the corner, looked at the venue itself, which was a dance floor with people dancing on it, and about 10 silver tops, very elderly people, men and women, 10 down one side of a long hall, 10 down the other side of this hall, and then at the end, bathed in deep blue and green light, as I remember, like not actual light, sort of atmosphere, and was a stage with a band doing some lovely Irish folk music as three or four people slowly danced in the middle of the room. And I have to say, I looked at it, and dear reader, dear listener, I thought, no, this isn't going to work. I can go up there and die on my ass for 20 minutes as hard as the next guy, as bravely as the next guy, but there is no point. So I'm not going to do it. And I didn't stamp my foot. I spoke to the producer. I texted the producer of the festival a picture of the gig. And he, to be fair, I think he texted me back. I didn't get it till 5 minutes later, but he said, "You're not doing this. Call me." But by that point, it had already been decided. And what was funny was the guys that were running the club there, or the you know, whatever it is, the sort of music night, they were very up for me doing it, and I could tell they. I mean, they started to appeal to. I don't know what my sense of identity as a comic. They started going in a very kind of predictable way. They started saying, if you were any kind of comic, you'd do it. And do you know what? Do you know what? Having done this for 20 years, I was able to look them in the eye and say, I'm not going to buy that because I've done this for long enough to know that I don't have to do this. I don't have to do this. I will do a gig if you provide me a gig, but this is not a gig. And I suppose I'm most proud of that I managed to stand there in the face of them calling into question whether I, you know, call yourself a comedian. I was able to stand there in the face of that and say, do you know what? That I am enough of a comedian that absolutely washes over me. I ain't doing it. And I got in my car, and it was all very amicably done, but I got in my car and I drove home and I rang my friend Matt, who is a variety and street performer, and he loves to hear tales of how awful the comedy industry is, the stand-up industry is in relation to his life and my former life, in that, you know, I think there's far more travel and it's far more lonely and in some cases poorly paid. But there's nothing performers like more than hearing about hideous situations. So I rang him and I told him all about it, and he laughed at me in a very, very supportive way. So what I take from that is that it's always good to ring people. I don't do that enough. On the way home on long drives, sometimes I'll ring comedian friends of mine who are also on long drives and have really good conversations. And there's a lot to be said for that. So in fact, if you're driving late at night right now, put the show on pause and just call up. If you've got a hands-free set, do it legally. Put the show on pause and call up a friend and tell them to download this podcast and then go to my website and pay for the fucking thing. It's the perfect conversation starter. So thanks for listening to that. Here is my one-minute money pitch. Here we go. Remember, the money pitches are all in 1 minute. Let's see if we can pull this one off and then we'll get back to David. Here goes. Today's show is brought to you by me and sponsored by no one. If you're enjoying the podcast, it's up to you to pay for it so it stays alive and I can keep on talking to more exciting guests. I know you guys like to support it, and thanks to everybody that has so far. I suspect the reason why you plan to go to comedianscomedian.com, click on the PayPal button and then select £20 or a pound a show and donate, but you haven't got around to it yet, is because you're driving or running or making angry love while you listen. And that means by the time you get to be in front of your laptop, you've forgotten about your desire to donate to the show. Totally understandable. Here's my solution. I want you now to imagine, focus in your mind, the indent button, the paragraph indentation button, that little button on the top left that shoves your cursor forward about a centimetre. And probably if you're a geek, it does something like it nudges the highlighted areas of the next one. I've no idea. It's a great little button. It pushes things forward. Imagine that button, right? Imagine my voice telling you to imagine the button. The next time you encounter that button at your keyboard, you're doing a letter or something, you're just about to press it, you're going to stop and think, oh yes, I must donate to the podcast now that I'm online.
1 minute and 2 seconds. That wasn't bad. So straight back into David. You'll remember from the first episode of this interview that David has given me an exclusive. If you're a fan of his stand-up, which I hope you are or will be soon, you'll know that one of his CDs from 2004, was called It's Not Funny. And it's just superb. It's a brilliant, brilliant album. It's on shuffle constantly in my car. It's always coming up. And I just love his work. Track titles on the album, as we're about to talk about on this show, they mock hack comic approaches, such as one of the tracks is called My Immigrant Mom Talks Funny. One of them is called Pandering to the Locals. Another is called Weathermen Have Become, for the Most Part, Obsolete. And the final track is called When All Is Said and Done, I'm Lonely and Miserable and Barely Able to Mask My Contempt for the Audience as I trot out the same sorry act I've been doing since the mid-80s. He's just great. So, David, that isn't the final track. You see, it is the final track on the album, but it shouldn't be, because David has given me an 8-minute MP3 clip of the alternate ending to this CD that his record company at the time wouldn't let him release. So I'm going to release the clip as its own little 8-minute podcast. If you've subscribed to this show, you should receive it automatically in your pod of choice. It'll download as this one did. And if you're listening on SoundCloud, then you can find it in the usual place via comedianscomedian.com. That is that. Let's get back to David as we discuss his track titles.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
In one of the things I loved about your albums, a couple of them, are the track titles, that might be something you've been asked a lot about before. I mean, it really, really made me laugh. The titles of the tracks on your album, rather than be the subject you're talking about, are kind of very, very brilliantly written as well, I should add. Kind of cliched tropes of stand-up. Exactly. So, you know, track number 9, if baseballs had AIDS on them, or whatever it is, you know. And those really, really made me laugh. Were they...
I have to tell you, I didn't want to waste an opportunity. So any time I could find a place to put humor, I did.
Yeah.
I did that for the first 2 CDs. And Bigger and Blacker does not have that.
Yes.
Because... I found over the years, like trying, I'd have to reference it, or somebody would reference it, and I would have no fucking clue what they were talking about. I couldn't answer their question. Yes. Couldn't answer their question.
Yeah.
I didn't know what they were talking about.
On this section that says My Immigrant Mom Talks Funny, you mean like there isn't that, no such bit exists?
Well, like that great bit, you know, it's, and they would know it because they've looked at it, and I wouldn't be able to engage at all, and then it would be 5 minutes like, what? Wait, what? Have to Google it and look it up.
Yeah.
So when I was doing the track listings for that, I was like, all right, fuck that. This is such a pain in the ass. I'm not gonna do it anymore. But
I was gonna ask, did you ever get, because that's mocking some of the tropes of stand-up comedy, do you feel you have a kind of a place within the stand-up comedy community, either now or when you were more gigging in the clubs? And do you feel like, is that the sort of behavior that could piss off those kind of comics that do that sort
again,
of material?
I don't give a shit. I don't care. They can be upset. Nobody said anything to me. I doubt they ever would. But that's all from, you know, spending whatever it was, however many years on the road and doing club stuff. I mean, 10 years, I think, roughly. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of going all over America, you know, and you'd leave your... you know, intellectual, culturally refined neck of the woods, whether it was Boston or New York, and you'd travel. You didn't have to travel that far, or even Atlanta, just travel outside of Atlanta, and it's just dumb, you know, people laughing at easier, simpler stuff. So it was that. It was based on, you know, that.
Speaking as someone who myself is doing a fair amount of road comedy at the moment, did that stuff pay off? Do you look back on it and go, well, that's where I learned my trade? Or do you look back and go, a lot of that was effectively pointless?
No, I think it... I don't know where I'd be without it, actually. I think it enabled me, it goes back to what I was saying along when we first started about I was, because of the boom, and I happened to be Boston, which was a, you know, kind of a big epicenter of that boom, and I happened to be there at that exact moment, I got all that stage work, and it allowed me to, because as I said, you don't want to bomb, you want to do well. It taught me to be in front of a crowd that didn't necessarily want to hear what I happened to have ready for them. If my set was, you know, 15 minutes or 30 minutes, I learned how to be on stage for 30 minutes saying things that people might not necessarily want to hear. And that was invaluable.
And what kind of, if you could distill those lessons down, what kind of lessons were they that you could give to someone now who might be listening to this, who's a comic, who feels that they've got stuff to say and it isn't going down the way they want it to, but they feel it's genuine? Is there some kind of...
Well, I can tell you what worked for me, and it did have 100% success rate, not even 90 or 80 or 75%. But what would work was humanizing yourself. And not as a victim or being somebody to be pitied, but this sense of, I'm a guy that you might like if I wasn't on stage saying this thing that you didn't like to hear. There's a lot of that kind of... You have to see the audience as an audience and not... You know that they're comprised of individuals, but an audience as a thing is much different than the parts that it's made up of. You know, they become this. It's weird, and I don't know that I'm explaining myself very well. But the audience is a thing. It's not that lady there with the arms crossed, and it's not that guy back there laughing in the back. It's a big, breathing, living thing that will be different every time. You're always going to be the same. That audience is going to be different, and you have to figure out. I'm not giving you constructive advice here, because I there aren't tricks and, you know, six things you can do, but you have to figure out how to talk to the audience and make them understand that they're also individuals and that you're an individual. And it's tricky, and it doesn't always work, but they will, if you're not just out there trying too hard and shouting at them, and, you know, and I've certainly made the mistake of probably too quickly going to the, well, fuck you, I'm just going to do what I want to do, mm-hmm. kind of attitude. You know, that was a lesson I learned, and it's... I suppose that would be my advice. Although I can't tell you exactly how to do it, because I don't know myself. It just becomes intuitive after a while.
But recognizing... So there's two things there. Recognizing and talking to the audience as an audience and as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And also letting them know that you said about humanizing yourself.
Yeah.
About making them realize that you are just one of them.
Yes, without being a victim, you know, without making them feel sorry for you. You want them to understand, like, as an audience, there's that kind of like, show me, especially fucking here, Jesus Christ, you know, what do you got? Like, prove yourself.
Is that something you find typical of British?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty. Yeah, it's been my case most. I mean, Happy Mondays was great. But I think a lot of people knew who I was, and there was like, but I've done plenty of gigs here where it's. It really is like, prove yourself to me.
Mm.
And I would say the highs are higher here, but the lows are lower.
Okay.
You know, but I kind of like it. It's a challenge, you know?
If you were to, and I want to move on to the acting stuff as well in a moment, but if you were to...
How long is this podcast?
I don't know. I'm going to keep going as long as you get, until you go, okay, what the fuck, we're going to leave now.
This will... comfortably take you from London up to Edinburgh should you choose to drive.
That's where everyone will be doing it. I've got two main questions about the acting stuff, but I wanted to round off the stuff on your stand-up. I wanted to ask, if you were to review yourself, what kind of elements do you think... No, take the word review out of it, because we don't even think about critics. But in what elements of stand-up do you think, I wish I was better at that bit? Or
I tell you exactly. I wish I was a better... I wish I had the wherewithal, the desire, the skill to write jokes. I think I'd be really great if I could write, if I sat down and did what so many people do. Like, they write jokes out, they craft them out. And I write so many things. I mean, that's, I consider myself a writer way more than I do an actor or producer or stand-up. I mean, I write lots of shows and scripts and sketches and things. And but I just don't have... maybe I need to go to a hypnotist or something. I don't have the ability to sit down and write jokes and or take pre-existing jokes or bits, because I'll take my sets and then I'll transpose them and... is that the right word?
No. Transcript.
Transcribe them.
Transcribe.
And... And then try to go, okay, here's the essence of this joke. But the way that I attack and work on other projects I work on, which are, you know, stories with a beginning, middle, and end, or a sketch that has a beginning, middle, and end, I just don't... I just can't do it. And I wish I could. It's a fault of mine. And I wish I would prepare more. I think that's an old shitty habit I have from being able to justify not doing well by going, well, I didn't prepare, that's why. It's stupid, it makes no sense. But but yeah, I wish I was a better joke writer, you know, and had the responsibility, just could sit down and write. I just can't. I just sit and look, stare, and... I try to craft a joke and I can't do it.
And
a lot of it comes on stage and I have to hope that, I hope this is a good set. You know, that's where all my material comes from.
Okay. You know? So you do all of your writing on stage. You have a note, you have a thought, you take it on stage, you just say it normally.
And then you build on it. Yeah. I don't mean to imply that, you know, when you're hearing my CDs that's me riffing. No, that's been 100 sets of like taping myself going, oh, that bit, because I tend to I really digress. It's a huge problem I have where I will just... the other night was a perfect example. There are bits I never finished. I started one idea where I know what the ending is and it's great, but we never got to it. I introduced the idea, then I got sidetracked by my brain. Not in a good way. I mean, a lot of people like, you know, Robin Williams is a genius. Like, some of that stuff. Like, wait a minute. That was, you know, and I have a problem with... I do that. I err on that side too much. Now, when you see these sets, like the stuff you're, you know, the CDs and DVDs and the specials, that's after I got a set ready, and I will take all the stuff that I've accumulated, and I'll try to, you know, put a set together and what the right order is, and I'll do, and I, you know, I'll just go to UCB Theater in New York or LA and, you know, do like 5 nights where it's free and I pay for the room and you come down and the idea is you're going to see bits you've probably seen before, but I'm getting this ready. And then you go out on the road and then that's the set. And I certainly riff within it, but it takes a while to get that thing ready. And all the stuff that goes into getting that ready is just fucking around, for better or worse.
And do you enjoy that process, or does it feel like you're trying to scale a mountain to get it all there, to get it there and finished?
Well,
does it feel like work?
Sometimes it does, but luckily I'm not contractually obligated to do anything. I feel the only thing that dictates any of that stuff is my schedule. Like, I look at my schedule and I go, man, I'm not busy until January. That's I'm never going to get a hour and a half set ready, you know, tour ready by then. Maybe I'll work on some other stuff, but I know that I'm going to be working pretty much through August of next year. So then I go, well, if I do tour, it's going to be a ways off, so that gives me 9 months to fuck around so it doesn't feel like work. And then when I go, okay, I've got to do a tour, that's when it's work. But okay. In a good way. Not yeah. Bad work, but, you know.
Is the deadline helpful ever that you go?
Always. I will fuck around and not fuck around like having fun, fuck around, but just procrastinate and not focus. And having a deadline in anything I do is always helpful. And I actually work well with a deadline. I do pretty well under pressure. And I need it.
I wanted to ask about given the individuality of your voice as a stand-up, when you and Bob Odenkirk were writing Mr. Show, did you have the same line of attack on a subject? Do you come from a similar kind of political standpoint or a similar appreciation of the world? Were you working in tandem or kind of struggling over bits?
No, very much in tandem, but we are very different. We have different comic sensibilities. It really is that pairing has been, you know, because you can listen to Bob's stand-up or read his writing, listen to my stand-up, read my writing, and we're both very different. But what we create together is just the simple, and this really doesn't do it justice, but the simple, simplistic, I should say, way to look at it is, he's very much, he's a really good joke writer and funny scene idea person, and I come at it with a story element. Like, one of the great things about Mr. Show, I think, is that, you know, our sketches kind of had a, they felt like they had a bit of a travel to them. It wasn't just the same, you know, it wasn't the same idea over and over again.
Sure.
You know, and he, you know, he has more structure. He has more classic sketch structure to his stuff, and mine kind of veer out in the ridiculous craziness. And
did that tend to come from you, that aesthetic of characters wandering out and into the next one? Was that more you than him?
I don't know. I think we both, I think that would have been the two. I don't know that it was one person who said it. I had a sketch group in Boston where we would do that stuff, but that had already been done by Letterman, and we were both highly, highly, heavily, to a ridiculous amount, influenced by Monty Python.
Yeah.
It informed everything.
Sure.
And I think that was a natural, I think it was just two of us, you know, veered that way anyway, so it makes total sense. But it wasn't that, I can't imagine that one person brought it up, one person was obstinate. It just seems like so natural to what we're doing. We had a stage show before we did the TV show.
Okay.
We would get together and take our sketches. I mean, going back to the original origin, there was a very creative community of like-minded people in L.A., some people you know, some people you wouldn't, but we got this space, or this one manager, Dave Rath, got this space behind a disco, an unused disco on Hollywood Boulevard, and we'd basically make these shows with ourselves, for ourselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are probably 120 people, you know, upstairs, maybe not even, but we'd put these shows together, and it was a creative outlet for all of us, and Bob was putting a show together, and we had riffed some stuff at a party at a mutual friend's, and we were like, oh, that would be a great sketch. And we got together to write sketches, and then I had a sketch show the following week. You know, it was my night, you know, and I had a bunch of stuff, and Bob and I wrote like two things for that piece. And in both of our individual shows, the stuff we did together was just, like, you knew it immediately. It was magic. It was so far ahead of the rest of the stuff in his show and the rest of the stuff in my show. And we were like, we really should. I mean, when we wrote, it was effortless. And I mean, it just went in the exact right place. And so then we started writing shows together. And, you know, they fairly quickly, because we were both very respected in the underground there. And, and, you know, when the idea that we were doing the show together, there was a lot of buzz on it. And when people started coming and, you know, eventually it became Mr. Show. But it really is such a great marriage of two different sensibilities that he makes my stuff better, I make his stuff better, and it's a seamless blend. I mean, I can look at sketches and go, Bob wrote that, that was my idea, that's, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And but I think the whole, you know, it's good. It's in that, I mean, to be a bit pompous, it's in that Lennon-McCartney way of, you know, Lennon was very much his guy, McCartney was his guy, very different, but the stuff they made together, like, was great, you know? So.
Did you, at the end of that process, at the end of when you stopped working together, I know you did, like, a reunion thing a couple of years ago, did you, or recently?
Yeah, we just did last... oh, gosh, was it that long ago? It was, what did we do? Not like 6 months ago, I think we had a book out, so we did a little mini tour.
At the end of the original series, was it scary at all to finish working with someone having an effortless relationship and going back to doing solo projects?
No, it was not at all. I was sad to see it go and sad to see it end, but I was very, very, very much itching to get out of L.A. I did. I moved to New York as soon as I could. We did this movie together. It was based on a Mr. Show thing and with some of the other writers. And then as soon as that was done, I moved to New York. And I'd been wanting to move to New York since I moved to L.A. My joke was, because I moved to L.A. from Boston, it was like, I'm moving to L.A. so I can make enough money to move away from L.A., and hopefully never go back. But ended up marrying a girl born and raised Santa Monica, so there's that. I was very anxious to move on and to in my own, like, personal development, because Shut Up, You Fucking Baby came as a direct result of moving to New York. And that was me. That was, that was very much me and my experience removed from L.A. If I had not moved from L.A., that CD would not have been like that, and that I perhaps it wouldn't have resonated and had the visceral quality it did. And I think it was one of the more important things I've done. I'd say one of the five most important things I did for my creative and personal development was to move out of L.A. and move to New York.
And was that was the CD where you talked about the aftermath of 9/11?
Yeah. I mean, I was talking about it almost immediately after. The first person I saw talk about it in... it was really amazing. It was Marc Maron, and it was about a week and a half later, maybe. And he said to the audience, and it was raw. I mean, you can see things on your TV, but it was a very raw, crazy time. And I lived downtown, and they had a demilitarized zone basically on 14th Street, and they had tanks and fucking the army was there, and you had to bring proof of residency in order to get back if you went uptown to get back in, and then it was really empty. It was very strange, surreal, and look, it's not Gaza, it's not fucking, you know, half of the planet, and I say this knowing that it's relative, but it was a crazy, weird, surreal, awful thing. And I think part of why that CD resonates with people and why it was successful is because it came out so quickly after that, in a relative terms, as much as you can turn around a package CD. But, you know, people didn't know what to do, what to talk about, and the stand-ups wanted to talk. I mean, most of them were, like, itching. And there was a show, again, it was, like, 10 days later, maybe, and Mark went up, and he said, he asked the audience, is it okay to talk about 9/11 yet? And he didn't mean it as a joke. It was not meant at all to be a punchline. He really wanted to know if he could talk about it. And the collective, like, please, yes, you know, and he proceeded to. And it wasn't that funny, but it definitely inspired myself and I think a number of other people there, like, because just like we're clamoring to talk about it, and I just remember that how smart that was, you know, him asking the audience, is it cool, like being sensitive to people's feelings about it, like is it cool, and then the response was just so emotive, and it was like it just exhaling all this tension of the last week and just like, please, somebody talk about it.
That's like a distillation of what's great about stand-up, that you could easily pontificate and go, oh, it's a pressure valve for society and stuff, but you don't, you know, that's so much talk until you get a situation like that where presumably people go, nope, that's it happening in action. That's exactly
please,
what it should
please
be.
Please talk about it. Yeah, they everybody was, you know, they didn't say the word please so much. Sure. It's just, you could just...
Yeah,
as collectively as an audience, just this group of people, like, desperate, you know.
Did you have to be more careful in your material about that? Because there's no more stuff that you kind of that you edited or you know, mentally or whatever. Okay.
I mean, I guess the only thing I probably edited was stuff that was. Kind of visual, and because I watched the towers go down, and I have my own shitty stories about seeing what I saw, and so I took some of that out because it's a little dramatic and not necessary for the bit, but that was just sort of self-editing for the betterment of the whole, you know. It wasn't like there was subject matter I didn't talk about.
But that's interesting. You might have chosen to remove stuff because it was too dramatic. Yeah, because at the end of the day you're not giving a speech, you're doing stand up.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, listen, I can't let you go without talking a little bit about Arrested Development. Which was I wanted to ask how much of and with your other parts as well, I sort of get the impression from some smaller parts you've played on other shows that I love that you've been booked for those shows to play yourself or a version of yourself, or because they know and love you. So Hank on Community or Noah in Archer, and I know you're friends with H. John Benjamin. You know, there are, you know, you have enough of a profile now that you are booked to be a version of you, or to sort of I don't know, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I get the impression that some of your friends in comedy are going, oh, great, let's get David in to do this, and he can David it.
Right.
do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I didn't know that was a verb, but... yeah.
But with Arrested Development, given that it was so densely written and with so much foreshadowing of punchlines and jokes that pay off whole seasons later, were you able to bring... Did you purely just bring performance and bringing the script to life, or were you bringing your own jokes and tweaks and suggestions and stuff like that? What was it like to be in that kind of creative environment?
Initially, the pilot and the first couple episodes, first part of the first year, I riffed a lot more, and then I learned not to riff because I would just get it. It was a waste of time, and it was because of exactly what you're describing. It's never going to make it in. So much, I mean, we would shoot, I mean, it was 21 minutes, you know, what went on air, 21 and a half minutes, and we'd get 42 page scripts. So half of what you were doing anyway was never going to make it. So I learned fairly quickly not to improvise anymore. It just was a waste of time. I mean, sometimes you can't help it and you do it anyway. And, I can't. There's really nothing that I can point to outside of the first, like, seven or eight episodes that I think made it in, and then you just sort of stop. But then in the last series, I did improvise a little bit more, and they were encouraging. You know, they were fine with it. It's just, but you don't want to waste any time because, really, at that point, you're not getting, you know, serious season two and three. Like, we're so dense, getting these really long scripts, and it was cut to 21 and a half minutes, and like, you're just wasting everybody's time with your funny take on something, you know. So
that's funny. That's not dissimilar to the experience of watching it. The way we described that to a show before it became bigger, or when I was telling my friends about it, was to say, there's so many jokes in it. You can't turn to who the person you're watching it with it and go, I enjoyed that joke.
Yeah.
Because you'll miss the next two, you know what I mean, and a visual and something in the background and the rest of it.
Yeah.
Was that the most satisfying thing that you've worked on of someone else's? So that someone else's piece of writing?
Oh, yeah, for sure. It was... It's too bad that the memory of it, the actual making of it, and the memory of it is kind of sullied by the fact that every single episode we ever did was done with this weight of, are we going to get to make another one?
You know?
And that is a tough way to go into work and for everybody involved. And it was like that every single show. I mean, we didn't know. Our last season, every day we'd show up. Are we doing 18? Are they locking down the studio? Are they going to kick us off? Are we going to get to do 22? Are we going to do 16? Like, we just didn't know if that day was going to be our last day. And that spread out over, you know, months is a shitty way to work. Outside of that, it was all great. Great cast. You know, every time Mitch was on set, it was... exciting, like, you know, Papa's here, you know, and just a treat to be able to work with all those folks. It's great.
Was that, I mean, that's kind of, it's got to be in the running for one of the best ensemble casts in any...
I was, from the beginning and to this day, just, I'm amazed at the casting. The casting is just, like, and so much of us were... like, people didn't know who I was. I mean, like, comedy nerds knew who I was, but nobody knew who I was. Nobody knew who Will was, or Tony Hale, or Michael, or Allie. I mean, everybody. Everybody was, like, sort of has-beens, or nobody knew who they were, you know? And it was... I mean, I can't imagine anybody else's joke. It just doesn't...
Yeah, it
doesn't
compute.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, the casting on that show was just... monumental, you know. It's great.
And did you experience, I mean, that must have brought you, like, it brought you to my attention as a stand-up. Did that must have had ripples for your other work?
Absolutely.
That's sort of the most successful aspect of it.
Yeah.
Is that, what would you say then is the most satisfying work that you've done, your stand-up included? If you had to look at all of this huge breadth of stuff that you've done, what's the thing that you most think nailed it?
I did a commercial for AOL.
Please tell me this is a true story.
that is true. It's not my proudest moment.
Okay.
Yeah, I was in a gorilla suit. Ben Stiller directed it, actually. But, I think Mr. Show. I just find it was very special. It's still... resonates, it still it still holds up, and you know, we did things that hadn't been done and did them well. You know, I like most of my other stuff. There are a few things that I've written, produced, performances I've done that are clunkers, but I think that I guess that I'd say Mr. Show and I just did a movie that I really liked too. Wrote and directed a movie, but Mr. Show.
What was the movie that you just?
It's done? Called Hits.
Okay. Has this been released yet? You say you just did.
No, it was at the. We were here in at the Sundance Festival here in London. It did well here. It actually did quite well with the London audiences, but. Yeah, Mr. Show, I think.
And finally, what would be... Oh, I've got so much other stuff to ask, but I've got, you know, I've got, you've got a life to live, so have I.
It's not about us, it's about the listeners right now.
I know, well,
they've got shit to do.
They don't. They love it. they've got to drive to Edinburgh. It's right. What they've got to do. They love this stuff.
That's a very specific podcast.
Yeah. People get off at a service station near Fife and talk about it. What would be your best piece of advice to give to a stand-up, or the best advice you were given?
It really comes down to, and I've said this a million times, and I'm not the only one by far, but you just have to get up and do it. You can't daydream about how great you're going to be and what you're going to do. You have to get up there, do it. You're going to eat a lot of shit. Know that you are. That's fine. And I guess also be... I mean, I'm telling you, it's my advice to a young me, and I don't know how many of those are out there. Don't... You know, just be true to yourself and trust your... I mean, they're all trite, cliche things.
Okay, well, I'm just thinking, let me ask this in a different way. Something I like asking my guests is, what would be written on your comedy gravestone?
Oh, I know exactly what it is.
Go on.
Here lies David Cross. His last wish was to be cremated.
Thank you very much. So that was David, and you can see why in those 2 hours of conversation I didn't really want to cut anything. I thought that was all good stuff. I'm so grateful to David for coming on the show. This episode was co-produced by Nathan Wood, who is a very valued helper of mine. He edits the show together for little more than a line on his CV and the occasional book token. The pod gremlin, or podblin, for this episode was Olivia Phipps. Thank you, Olivia. And now I need another helper to be paid in peas, I'm afraid, and a very specific one. I'm putting together a new website, and it's going to be a slow process over the next few months because I've just discovered analytics. Yes, crazy, the dark magic world of analytics, which I can find out so much about you people, you listeners. None of it about you specifically, so don't get scared if you're secretly a terrorist. But I'm learning that 45% of you, I think, are women, which is great. I assume there'd be more of a male bias. Maybe the women should write to me more often. That sounded wrong. But from the emails, I'd assumed you were mostly blokes. So it's nice to hear that everyone is enjoying it sort of fairly equally. But there's all kind of information like that available to me that I'm not making use of at the moment because I don't understand it. Do you live in London or Bristol and fancy helping me out with understanding the murky, inky black world of web analytics? Could you perhaps describe yourself as a user builder? I only learned that term yesterday. This isn't just a web designer, I should stress. I've got a few of them in the can, some very useful people helping me. But I need a specialist in metadata, taxonomic tagging, and Google Juice. I've made up one of those terms. If you can tell which one, you've passed the first stage. Email me info@comedianscomedian.com with the subject line mega nerd, and let's have a conversation. I'd really appreciate some help with this. Thanks for listening. Drop in at iTunes, give me a 5-star review if you have a moment. Join in the Facebook group. You can follow me at ComComPod on Twitter. Interact with me using your favourite social media and or in real life. If you wouldn't mind clicking on the Facebook page, Stuart Goldsmith Comedy. So it's facebook.com/ Stuart Goldsmith Comedy. Just click like on that. I'm turning that into the new public Comedians Comedian page with the ComCom group, a sort of private VIP area. Unless my new mega nerd tells me otherwise. That's the plan for now. That MP3 of David Cross's little final track will be available downloading in your stream now, or you can find it at comedianscomedian.com. Speak to you soon. I'll speak to you soon. Yeah, I will. Next week. Who knows? I've got a couple of people in the can and also someone else that I'm trying to get. So a bit of a surprise for next week. I'll speak to you then.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.